So what I want to talk through today, it's going to be in three parts. And so, sorry, I'm managing two computers simultaneously, so let me just make sure I can do what I'm doing. All right, here we go. So in this talk, I'm going to be asking the same string of questions at least three times of three different things. What got asked, what were the answers, and what got made? My aim in asking these questions is to explore and propose a relation between what we're looking for and how we imagine its bounds and what we can do with what we find. In order to work to abolish the prison industrial complex, one of the key questions we ask of any step we consider is whether this step will foreclose the possibility of our long-term goals or whether it will bring us one step closer to them, by either chipping away at systems of domination or building capacities that make those systems increasingly obsolete. So this way of thinking ties what's often perceived as impossible to what is necessary, moving with a sense of simultaneous urgency and patience that marks what Avery Gordon has called abolitionist time. So in this talk today, I'm hoping to explore the abolitionist imperative of working in two places at once, this movable, shapeable present, and the imaginable longed for future. So part one, how we know what we know. How we know what we know is of course political. What we understand to shape the knowledge with which we work, who we believe knows things, and where and when we look or listen for what is or has been known, are all themselves this part of this politics of knowing. And I would argue the politics of language it sounds like you've been talking about today. Historian Paula Austin, from whom these images come from her research, argues that the intellectual lives of young Black, poor, and working class people in an expanding Washington, D.C. in the 1920s and 30s can be pulled forward by reading between the lines of long-form sociological interviews from this period. In a city known both for its rigid Jim Crow segregation and as the nascent symbol of American democracy at the time, Austin finds that interviewees use the occasion of the interviews and the attention of the interviewers to frame their own arguments about and theories of this segregationist city, especially through their navigations of its built environment and the places that were both open and closed to them. In her study, Austin proposes that reading sources created through the social science of the time, doing what Sadia Hartman has called reading against their limits, allows us to shape new understandings of Black intellectual history. In her book, Coming of Age in Jim Crow DC, Austin rereads the voices of several young people interviewed for a famous study by the Black sociologist E. Franklin Frazier. This sociological project endeavored to challenge the racial science of the day, which asserted that African-American experiences of poverty, unemployment, single parenthood, and the Black social life itself, when it fell outside the bounds of white middle-class norms, were attributable to fundamental difference between so-called races that was biological in nature. Austin argues that living in the cognitive, political, and social dissonance of a city and a country, simultaneously disciplining Black lives through racial, gendered, classed, and spatial policing, and also making itself into a showcase internationally for equality, shaped the understandings of young people about how to navigate these living spaces. Her aim now is not to focus on the limiting notion that young voices can be read only to describe their, quote, struggles against or accommodations to, unquote, the social and political landscape. She argues that rather by examining the critical role of ideas in navigating structural impediments to full identity formation and expression, even for people deemed both too immature and racially inferior to engage fully in intellectual life, the voices within these pages stress the generative capacities of poor, young, Black, and working class people's interior lives and political will. In a discussion of the primary archival materials with which she worked, Austin describes how Frazier instructed the young, mostly Black middle class interviewers to build relationships with the young people they studied, and how the resulting interviews of the young folks themselves and of their immediate communities of family members, other adults, and sometimes peers were made. She writes, "While interviewers asked questions that often sought to reinscribe tropes about Black working class communities, ones that classify particular cultural productions as raced, gendered, and classed, Sometimes subjects provided answers that reinforced these, and other times they did not. Sometimes they answered a question they had not even been asked and took the opportunity to tell stories of themselves and their histories. Other times they discussed ideas the interviewers were not expecting and which were not ultimately used in official publications or reports. So as she read, Austin explains, she learned to see these moments of what she calls thoughtfulness and introspection, engagement, inflection, and of tangents, obfuscation, and deflection. In honing this particular means for listening to the transcripts, hearing the voices of young people in relation to the structure of the interview, but not bound by it, she built capacities to reweave and reimagine the meanings that perhaps had been figured out of these stories and the theories they had shared in their official publication. Austin describes specifically the work of reconstituting interview transcripts that had been literally cut up by the sociologists as they did their work. Unlike interviews of family members or of other adults in their communities, which she found in their original transcript form, kind of like what you can see here, the archives provided the young people's interviews as a collection of note cards organized by themes of analysis, such as recreation, gangs, interracial relations. These cards were anonymized with codes that indicated the interviews from which they come, but otherwise were detached from any contextual information, connecting the ideas represented from other answers and from the linked stories of family members, friends, and other members of the community. So in order to begin learning the voices of the young people she'd followed into the archive to begin with, Austin explains that first she needed to reconstruct their interviews, both as a means of undoing or not falling into what she calls the artificial categories that Fraser had produced, and also in order to hear these young people fully. Only then could the ideological frameworks, the contextual lives and experiences, the arguments and silences of whole people, whole young, Black, poor, and working class people situated in their time, their neighborhoods and communities, begin to be learned from. So this method of reconstruction was informed by a methodology that focused on finding the intellectual work of the young people to whom she listened in the archive. The goal was not to reclaim or rescue a submerged sense of absolute agency on their behalf, but to learn from their own engagement with their identities and the structures that both shaped and were shaped by them, and from their complex subjectivities. Through this double labor of reassembling and then learning to listen to what can now be accessed at another register, as Austin puts it, she reconstructs understandings of their practices of making and imagining, even as these themselves had to operate sometimes as what images, or as the invention of temporary interventions on and reclamations of what was not inherently, but was constructed and policed as white middle-class space. Critically, she does not do this work alone. She points to the methodological approaches in slavery and post-colonial studies and in labor histories of women. She notes that these fields, quote, distinctions between the everyday survival strategies of individuals and collective resistance are collapsed, unquote. So while changing understandings of previously fixed-seeming categories of agency and of public and private sites of engagement emerge, we imagine how to look and listen. As Austin argues, quote, this literature builds a social history that considers the relationships between ideologies and the material, political, and social realities in which they are developed, and between the everyday and the production of ideas. So as historical engagements with the production of knowledge in precarious conditions, for personal use, as it were, and as community knowing toward and beyond survival, this work reminds us, or maybe teaches us, that theories for living arise through what Saidiya Hartman has called the refusal to be governed. Further, the evidence of this knowing often has to be found through looking and listening practices that read official histories, often disciplining ones, against the grain. The methodology is an intentional one, as Austin describes as, quote, lingering in the archival materials, reading at a different register. She says this allows us to see and hear what is already there. Listening in this way, Austin is able to tell us stories of, for example, young Black people's strategies in the 1920s and 30s in Washington, D.C. for using public space while avoiding police who attempted to remove them from those spaces, efforts to understand and engage the construction of whites-only play areas in historically Black neighborhoods, and political investments in Black political organizing. So I begin with this historical work because its epistemology, methodology, and methods inform a very new project of mine, one that Dagny mentioned, in which I'm looking into the knowledge and system and material making practices of social movements and people living in relation to systems of oppression. I'm also interested in the role designers have played in creating some of the mechanisms of these systems themselves. And this is what I'll turn to for the rest of the talk. So following Gatt and Ingold, who argue for designers and others to, quote, recognize that the creativity of design is not found in the novelty of prefigured solutions to perceived environmental problems, but in the capacity of inhabitants to respond with precision to the ever-changing circumstances of their lives. These stories, and the many that are available when we look, suggest the importance of both everyday and organized making practices rooted in and emerging from people's lived experience in relation to systems of domination. So my work is largely with political organizers working to end what is what we often call the prison industrial complex, an organization that I'll talk about in a bit called Critical Resistance, with whom I've done a fair amount of work. Defines the prison industrial complex, or the PIC for short, as, quote, the overlapping interests of government and industry that use surveillance, policing, and imprisonment as solutions to economic, social, and political problems. So central to this work is the question of what it is that these systems do and how they are supported in that by a common sense that presumes that they are both necessary for producing or securing safety and that they are permanent. So for example, I missed a slide somehow. There we go. So for example, in 2016, when New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton stepped down from his second stint in that job to engage in private sector security consulting, he said in his farewell speech, "Policing is never done. It's always unfinished business. The issues that we're facing now are going to require years to solve." So in this, Bratton defined the terms of the present and future world as one that should be known and engaged and whose issues could only be solved through the business of policing. In contrast, scholar Angela Davis argues that we have, quote, internalized the notion of the jail or prison as a place to put bad people. She continues by saying, why is that person bad? The prison forecloses discussion of that. What is the nature of that badness? What did the person do? Why did the person do that? If we're thinking about someone who has committed acts of violence, why is that kind of violence possible? Why do men engage in such violent behavior against women? The very existence of the prison forecloses the kinds of discussions that we need in order to imagine the possibility of eradicating those behaviors. If we imagine prison in this way, we also typically understand policing to be the system that enables and secures the identification of bad people to put in cages. So the common sense notion that policing and imprisonment are permanent and necessary guides many contemporary practices of making in a range of design fields. In distinction, the presumption of abolition is that policing, imprisonment, and related structures of violence not only do not address harm and social problems, but they produce them and are used in addition to constrain dissent against them. So common sense shapes the kinds of questions we ask, as much as expectations of the purpose of knowing for design processes shapes the kinds of answers we might find or imagine to be useful. So I want to explore how this plays out in the production of knowledge for and through different approaches to designing next, through sort of 2.5 stories. Systems theorists Susan Lee Starr and Karen Rudletter, whose work has been instrumental in opening up modes of understanding and inquiring into infrastructural systems and participatory design, note that one dimension of infrastructure is that it becomes visible upon breakdown. Infrastructures like the PIC complicate this argument. Their relative invisibility is supported paradoxically by the hypervisibility of rhetoric and media surrounding them, which construct them as necessary. And they are also made visible through the harms they cause to those caught up in them by the violence they perpetrate in people's day-to-day lives. Increasingly, research in design points us to these kinds of infrastructures and beyond the PIC, which is a particular sort of massive structure in the United States, although it also exists in many forms internationally. One of the things that I think we see in many places in the world our systems of border and migration policing, issues with the built environment, capitalist economies that are driven by consumer spending on the one hand and financial products on the other. And in these infrastructures, we see that what is taken for granted by some exacts myriad tolls on others, often by design. So these are also sites of invention and resistance, sites of infrastructuring, in which people affected by these systems design interventions, legal or extra-legal, as they navigate and circumnavigate their harms. So far from only being made visible when they break, infrastructures like these are made visible to some or to all in widely varied ways through the work they are intended to do and through their material consequences in everyday lives. So I want to briefly share two examples, not from my own work, but of points of analysis that are linked by their focus on designing for policing and imprisonment, by their responsiveness to contested political context for these projects in two major US cities, and by their methods and outcomes. In 2015, following the police killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, among others, and the uprisings that followed, the architect Jean Gang and her firm, Studio Gang, developed a project that sought to do what they called engaging a renewed national conversation on policing reform. They asked, how can design help people imagine changes in police-community relations? Using a May 2015 report issued by President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing as a design brief, they sought to turn attention to spatial possibilities through reimagining the design of the police station, as well as its relation to the neighborhood in which it sits and operates. To do this, Studio Gang organized what they call community cafes, and they asked people from neighborhood organizations, religious institutions, local young people, police and city planners to reimagine the police station with them. The process led with three prompts. What would a police station look like as a mixed-use facility? If the community designed a police station, what would it look like? And how does the station contribute to police and community relationships? The resulting proposal, which they called Polis Station, argues that, quote, police stations be reoriented toward their communities and become sites of social connection where officers and neighborhood residents can find many opportunities to interact. So just one note here, as many of you likely know, these uprisings in 2014, 2015 are seeing a redux now in 2020. And many of those uprisings stemmed in part, one could argue that the causes are actually very deep and very complicated and very long in coming, but in part from the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. And this was one of several police and racially motivated murders that seeded these ongoing uprisings this summer internationally. Prior to this, the Minneapolis Police Department had actually instituted nearly every recommendation from this Obama task force from 2014-2015. And that did not limit or change the violence enacted by police, and most notably did not stop Chauvin from killing George Floyd, a point that many of the organizers on the ground in Minneapolis have made several times as they call for police defunding. So Polis Station seeks to reimagine the police station itself, as well as create a police-centered community development plan. So this includes, just as some examples, and you can see many of them here on the slide, residency incentive programs that facilitate police officers specifically and others with key service jobs living in the area where they work by offering financial assistance to rebuild, renovate, and improve homes in the neighborhood, creating shared amenities where police and residents might interact outside of situations of conflict, making police stations into information hubs that offer free Wi-Fi and news, generating ties between police academies and local educational institutions, and making the station itself into what they call a community center, with the outward-facing side including social and community services like daycare and a law library, while what they call the secure side faces the back and is out of sight. Polis Station, developed through what they call a participatory process and framed through questions posed by designers, proposes, quote, to form a network of dispersed recreational, educational, entrepreneurial, and green spaces with the aim of creating a safer community with the Polis Station at its heart, unquote. So not long after, in the city where I live, In 2017, multiple factors, including ongoing organizing by a number of nonprofit organizations and formerly imprisoned people and their loved ones, led to an announcement that the city would be moving to close its notorious jail, Rikers Island, and replace it with a series of borough-based jails. So just for context, Rikers is a whole island that locks up over 9,000 people on a given day, as many as two-thirds of whom are awaiting trial and just can't make bail, so have not been convicted of anything. The city engaged a Justice in Design committee as part of this work to propose what they asked for as, quote, state-of-the-art facilities located closer to where the courts are operated in civic centers in each borough. So New York City is made up of five different boroughs, which you can actually see on this map here. And they asked them to create jail designs that are more healthy, rehabilitative, and respectful. So like the police station designers, the group held design workshops in which they asked people with a range of relationships to the criminal legal system to engage with five questions, which you can see on the screen here, all but one of which has a jail at its center. They asked, they engaged these questions to ask how the idea of borough-based jails might contribute to addressing the harms Rikers causes to mostly Black and Brown people in New York City. The architectural, urban planning, service, and economic design proposals that resulted are called justice hubs. And they describe these as, quote, facilities that create healthy, normative environments and support rehabilitation for incarcerated or detained individuals while simultaneously providing neighborhoods with new public amenities. These include, quote, on-site programs such as job training centers, community courts, a police department, and probation offices. And they bring multiple uses into one site. They frame the justice hubs in this report as, quote, public sites of civic unity that are envisioned to benefit those who live and work inside, while also acting as, quote, new community resources woven into the fabric of neighborhoods to provide much needed services and community facilities. So in their efforts to engage people in the design of what they called spaces of policing, Studio Gang aimed to open up their idea-generating process outside the studio in a way that might be familiar to many of us. But they did so with their imagined outcomes already squarely in the frame. They were going to make a building or a station that could meet the call of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Of course, there's one simple way to understand this imposed limit. Studio Gang is an architecture studio. This is what they make. Similarly, the process that led to the proposal for the justice hubs in New York City followed a familiar path. Once the general idea was taken up by the city, the design committee also sought to consult with communities and brought the ideas gleaned from these workshops together with political, geographical, and architectural requirements to frame the solutions, what they called justice hubs. But the resulting proposals, one, a neighborhood-wide spread of police and policing institutions into multiple sites and buildings, the other, a neighborhood with a jail at its core, both of which tie the delivery of long-needed and underfunded services to these policing and jailing spaces, demonstrates the net effect of the questions asked, the knowledge sought, and the common sense frameworks of each. So this brings me to say that how designers understand the nature and origins of our knowing matters for what might be made and to whom it is accountable. Indeed, in both Chicago and New York City, active organizing work to stop the expansion of policing on the one hand and the proposed new jails while also still closing Rikers on the other were a prominent part of the political and social landscape in which this work was and is still happening. Just 15 minutes from the proposed site of the new police station, activists in Chicago have now for multiple years protested a site of police torture at Holman Square, in a city in which a successful long-term organizing campaign led to reparations, $5.5 million in reparations, to mostly Black and Latinx people who had been held and tortured over two decades by Chicago police. In New York City, the No New Jails Coalition actively opposed the new jails, arguing that no cage is humane, and that if New York City could afford to build $10 billion worth of new jails, maybe the city could instead imagine and build other ways to support and sustain people in communities and counteract the harms of both Rikers and the intense policing of Black and Brown people that landed so many there to begin with. So in these instances, the questions asked were bound both by the common sense of imprisonment and policing, and presumably by the design brief. Given these constrictions, What is the role then of creating spaces and processes for community knowledge production in relation to these kinds of projects? What kinds of knowledge are accessed and how, and what can be imagined and made from them? What might it have done to the designing process, to the knowledge produced through and for design in these cases, to have listened and looked elsewhere? So I want to transition to a final example by returning to where we began and thinking about knowledge production in the context of both everyday living in relation to infrastructures of harm and organized making practices that resist, refuse, or seek to circumnavigate their limitations and long reach. How might we imagine designing from and through people's practices of dissent or survival to imagine otherwise? Or what might an abolitionist design look like, and what kinds of knowledge production practices does it require? So this last example arises from my own political and design work with critical resistance. In 2015, the Critical Resistance Oakland, California chapter, anti-policing or no cops working group, launched the Oakland Power Projects. And this aims to, quote, help Oakland residents invest in practices, relationships, and resources that build community power and well-being by identifying current harms, amplifying existing resources, and developing new practices that do not rely on policing solutions, reminding us that we can make our families and neighborhoods safe and healthy without relying on the cops, end quote. So in full disclosure, and also because I'm about to talk about how designers are positioned in this work, I'm a longtime member of CR. And while I did not live in Oakland at the time I did this research, I have lived there before. And I knew some of the people, though not all, in the working group with whom I worked over a couple of years. I both know well and deeply believe in the political objective of the organization. And I also know and understand its working processes. So for instance, the organization makes all decisions by consensus, works through collective practice, and practices at this in many ways. So this did not mean in any way that the work was not without complexity or conflict, but it did create a kind of ground for knowing and learning together and some shared goals. So Oakland Power Projects, or OPP as I'll call it, began after, as CR explains, quote, more than 2 years of fighting a successful campaign against gang injunctions in Oakland as a part of the Stop the Injunctions Coalition. So just very briefly, gang injunctions are a really complex sort of legal construct that essentially allowed a hyper-policing of particular neighborhoods and people under the auspices of gang control. So they imposed curfews, they imposed limits on who people could spend their time with, and allowed for a particular kind of policing in particular neighborhoods where they were put in place. So when the city abandoned its two temporary injunctions and moved on to other policing schemes that continued to fail the people of Oakland, and this is CR's talking, through a steady and intentional process, CR members talked to close allies from the Stop the Injunctions Coalition to get a sense of the perception and experience of current policing landscape in Oakland, and to ask what work could reduce the reach of policing into Oaklanders' daily lives and take steps toward making policing obsolete. So this leads us to the last project I want to talk about. As a final consideration, I want to turn to specifics of knowledge production and conditions of collective work in the development of the Oakland Power Projects. Because of my position in relation to this story, it is much more mine, so to speak, than those that have come before. I also want to tell it at a slightly more intimate scale, with a focus on how the group came to develop and understand the tools and processes or infrastructures that we made for learning from Oakland residents toward identifying projects to take up. It seems important to say directly that we too had constraints and frameworks within which we were working. So OPP, like all CR work, was going to be an abolitionist project. So as I noted at the very start today, this meant that we were looking for ideas that would both work toward the long-term goal of making policing obsolete and also the shorter-term goals identified by the group as part of that work, which included shifting public discussions away from policing as a solution toward amplifying and building other possibilities for creating well-being. So here's how CR describes the process of OPP. And you can kind of see this image here. So we identify projects through a multi-step process. We start by having one-on-one interviews with Oaklanders about their experiences of their city and neighborhoods, their experiences with police, and their dreams and ideas for creating well-being in Oakland. Through collective listening and reflection on the themes, concerns, and ideas that arise in interviews, we map out common threads. From those, we choose an idea to develop with the people who raised the idea and others who are well situated to begin capacity and strategy building around the project theme. Together, we workshop ideas and needs to arrive at a shape, goals, and next steps for the project, along with finding a core of people to organize and carry it out. The long-term goal is to have multiple projects taking on and remaking approaches to well-being at once and reducing the harmful influence of policing on the city and on people's lives. So the OPP interview questions are intended to raise up, which you can see on the left side of my screen, are intended to raise up ideas of what people like and desire in their city, how ideas of safety and policing are or are not connected, and what people's expectations are of police responsibilities, and how else maybe those expectations could be met. Once the group began conducting interviews and collecting stories, the question of how to listen to them, how to record the content and learn from it towards seeding projects that would make it useful came to the forefront. Part of what I did was to create a proposal in three parts, including a system for managing and storing interviews, which we never used, doing notation of themes and ideas using what I called an interview notepad, which you can see a version of on the right side of the screen, and gathering the information from the notepad pages onto a larger shared chart in the Oakland office. And this came into use much later. So we started with the notepad. So group members noted that the hardest part of the work might be trying to extract project ideas from the interviews, and that developing some shared language by doing collective listening would be helpful. To create themes and keywords to include in the notepad, the group tested out listening to an interview together and marking up a mock-up I'd made of a sort of possible first version of this sheet. In doing this, they noticed that when they listened to the interviews and reflected on them together, working on the notepads, quote, helped them think in similar ways, end quote. This established a theory for the practice of listening together, that it created shared language that would help the group use what they were learning from the interviews themselves to move toward their goal of identifying a project to take up. And it also produced an actual form, this piece of paper, that could work for this purpose. So honing the notepad became a means, this very sort of humble basic sheet of paper, literally, became a means for actually designing and redesigning theory and form and practice together. It became a way of creating a relationship to the knowing people already had, as well as to the things we were hoping to learn from the interviews and from each other in the process of listening so that we could make something from them. To this end, the notepad also became a way to establish a practice of listening for patterns and themes. So as another group member noted, quote, it helps us to think about the interviews as we're doing them or immediately after. We're looking at this thing and we're like, okay, well, how does this fit? Not only like that person's response was really interesting, but also when I look back at this sheet and I'm checking off boxes and I think about it, I say, oh yeah, that's not something that was interesting in that person saying, but it was interesting because every single time I've done one of these interviews, I've checked off that box. So this included recording and thinking with responses that resonated with our established political goals and those that might complicate the narrative. Using the interview pads, we were able to work with both stories about, for example, people's efforts to build a community garden as a space to create food and relationships, and those from people who did call the police for things. And we were able to make notes on what it was that people hoped for, what they got, and what they felt might be missing from both. So testing the notepad led to further conversations about how to gather and use the information coming from the interviews to move toward a specific project, and how to make the notepad as useful as possible for this purpose. So this wall chart I mentioned earlier that I'd initially proposed as a means for making sense together of their interviews reemerged as a tool that was ready when NoCops members agreed it was time to move toward planning a first project. While the wall chart in its use served this sort of basic instrumental function, you can see people literally sort of marked it up with stuff from the interview sheets, it did this in part because it was also a site for continuing to make knowledge together to move that work and the group's goals forward, right? So it wasn't used as a way to quantitatively figure out what was being said most, but rather to gather a lot of things in one place to foment conversation. It was, as one member noted, quote, a transition point. We got to sit there with all of the material that we were drawing out and ask, what do we do next, given all of these patterns and themes that are coming out? What's most exciting to us? What is the most interesting? What do we think will bear the most fruit? And we asked ourselves questions about that. Another member noted that the wall chart, while holding the particulars of every story, was focused on finding patterns. Quote, ideas people have about what is needed, again, in these times when only dominant things are visible or available, unquote. The chart's utility to us as a group came, she noted, in part because, as she said, we live in the same clarity. We do have a lot of shared ways of seeing things, unquote. Another said the chart worked as a collective analysis tool, that it, quote, clearly worked because we came up with something. And I think that was probably the fastest decision we ever made in this project, end quote. The decision itself, too, was a surprise. A need emerged from the process that none of us had anticipated, working to decouple medical and mental health care from policing. And this became the first Oakland Power Project. In this way, the wall chart stands as an example of what we come to learn to make together. It was context specific, but it was also a very simple, imperfect manifestation of what was needed and of our capacity built over time to move through what we knew and what we didn't know to try to make what was needed provisionally again and again. The context for our designing and for the organizing process itself was critical as it determined both what problems the group posed as a focus for our work and the framework for what would be considered ideal or even acceptable outcomes. As one member reminds us, something we've been talking about as a chapter has been how to identify what are the spaces or the windows of opportunity to organize against the PIC. And then how do we move ourselves, our labor, our skills, our resources into a vehicle or formation that takes best advantage of that? Because we're thinking of long-term resistance in Oakland or to the logic of policing, there's not this small window of opportunity that means we need to figure out how to gather around a particular thing. Instead, we're having to do a formation that seems newer to the organization, and this project is helping us do that. So what we made and did was guided at all times by the long-term goals of the organization and the strategic decisions being made day-to-day, month-to-month, about how to shape campaigns and projects working toward that goal. We might call this a kind of abolitionist engagement with knowledge production, where the work of making knowledge is both tied to stated political goals and is open to the relation between what is known and unknown, to the productive intellectual work of analyzing shifting landscapes and listening, as Paula Austin said, at another register to understand what can be made and done in the present that seeds possibilities for the future as well. So to end, I want to make a very quick pivot towards thinking specifically about the position of the designer in making knowledge and what can be made with and from it with people. So by this time in our work together, NOCOP's members and I were engaged in a process that allowed us, not without missteps or limitations, to design together by making ways of arguing, articulating, and knowing. Throughout this research period, questions about how to do the things the group wanted to make possible were often recursive and cyclical, presenting not so much as new problems, but as familiar ones that remained unresolved. How to talk to people about the project, how to make sense of an offensive campaign, how to choose a path forward. This is often where our designing activity stepped up, creating ways to insert ourselves into the problems of organization or knowing that presented themselves and to reach next immediate steps. When I reflected on the work NOCOP's members and I did over time, what I saw was that as we worked together, what I might have called my practice was increasingly constituted by instances of collaboration in which what I had been thinking of as mine or what I was doing started to become diffused among people in the project. I began to understand that my practice was neither only mine nor mostly articulated by me. It was instead increasingly not only collaborative and participatory, but something I started calling co-authored more than co-designed. If an accepted idea of co-design is in part determined by relationships between designers and participants in design processes in which their positions as organizer and actor remain fairly constant, this idea of co-authorship refers to a shared practice in which both the context for designing and the design work itself are collaboratively shaped. As one member characterized our emerging practice, quote, the basic structure of the group is the same, but also it's like you're that person on the ship's bow too, with your eyes toward the design or how things might be facilitated better in the project sense. And so we're all with our eyes outwards looking at what next to do, like you're doing that also. You're doing it, so it's not the same as before. We're all continuing to do what we do. So in all this, I am trying to find acceptable methodologies and orientations for design. These would, I hope, refuse to claim making practices that are daily created and made meaningful by people for themselves as design, nor rely on the instrumentalization of people's own changing, incomplete, and necessarily contradictory knowledge for designing. What is at stake in designing with people and learning through our own practices, what this means is, of course, what is at stake in the work we join into, even if it is also ours already or becomes ours in the process. So here, I was concerned with how CR members and I could create capacities in and through our organizing and designing practice to do what cultural studies scholar Lawrence Grossberg calls telling better stories about what's going on, in order to, quote, articulate the negativity of the present to the positivity of the future. As my research progressed, I wondered if and how designing together was also productive of knowing together, and what this meant for what design could do to change these dominant narratives about police, or more to the point, what it might mean to feel safe and free in Oakland. Listening to the group's stories, and with them to Oaklanders' stories, opened up possibilities for the stories we could tell in turn. Possibilities for new questions, strategies, and imagined futures. Thank you all so much.